I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Kansas Department for Children and Families is struggling. Caseworkers in the Kansas City area are handling cases at a number well above the average. Today, DCF Secretary Gina Meyer-Hummel reports on the challenges the department faces. Not enough personnel, inadequate training, and the safety of the children in her care. We'll ask about hiring people who don't have social work degrees and why she's employing outside contractors. Then, Kansas City trumpeter Stan Kessler will jazz up the morning. In between tracks from his new release, we'll ask how he's managed to make a living in the genre and how he keeps his sound relevant after 40 years in the business. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. For the Kansas Department of Children and Families, the struggle to protect the state's most vulnerable kids continues. A new report points out that child welfare workers investigating abuse and neglect are supposed to carry a maximum caseload of about 15. But in the Kansas City area, workers have been averaging 55 cases. What's being done about it? We're about to find out as Gina Meyer-Hummel, Secretary of the Kansas Department of Children and Families, is here to give us an update. Gina, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
You know, these caseworkers I just mentioned in the Kansas City area are averaging more than three times, sometimes four, the suggested maximum caseload. How are you addressing it?
Yes, thank you. We have, of course, changed the criteria for our staff that we're hiring into our Child Protective Services positions. We did that several months ago, and as a result of that, we've been able to decrease the number of vacancies in the agency. So we went from having, as an example, 30 vacancies in Wichita to having no vacancies because we changed the criteria of our staff.
How about in Kansas City?
In Kansas City, we've made progress. We are not completely full yet, but we've made significant progress. So, I mean, for years they have had the same and been expecting the, you know, new social workers to come and do the work. And as we studied the issue, they just weren't coming and they weren't going to be graduating enough to fill the positions we had. So we looked at what was happening across the country and we changed our criteria to fit with that.
Which means you're hiring people who used to have social work degrees to do social worker jobs. You're not able to find enough degree holding candidates any longer.
So we still have, the folks we're hiring still have a social service degree of some sort. They just don't have a social work per se degree.
You know, that step is a little bit controversial. Laura Kelly, the Democratic candidate for governor, has expressed concerns about that approach. Should the public be concerned about people who are don't have these degrees doing this work?
I really don't think so. I have a degree in social work, of course, and I have a master's degree in social work administration and clinical social work. And while I think social work is a great option for folks who do this work, I mean, we know that there are people who have great skills, who have other degrees, who've been working in and around the arena and with at-risk families for years. And so we've been able to open up that job market, and we've had plenty of really great experienced staff come in to do the work.
So in the Kansas City area, I mentioned in the opening, workers here were averaging about 55 cases each. What is it today?
I don't know that exact number today. We certainly can get back with you about that. What I can tell you is our vacancy rate across the board is down to 9%. So from upwards of 20% to 9% across the entire state.
You know, I'm wondering, these caseworkers who investigate abuse and neglect involving children, what happens to their ability to get their jobs done when they're juggling so many cases?
Yeah, it's an issue for sure. Because, I mean, again, we're asking them to look in and investigate some of the most serious concerns that happen in families' lives and, you know, in their private homes. And so they'll be getting new referrals and investigating and following up on concerns, and then they'll get new referrals on top of that. So it is important to have an adequate workforce to be able to do the work effectively and efficiently. And then, of course, the ultimate goal is to provide services if we find that a family is at risk of something. And so we need them to be able to investigate thoroughly, put prevention mm-hmm. services in place, follow up to make sure prevention services are happening and working in order to keep kids safe. If if we don't have an adequate workforce and they're asked to do too much is when children's safety is compromised.
I was going to say, as the leader of the Kansas Department of Children and Families, how much do you worry that a serious case might sort of get lost in the shuffle with your workers handling so much?
Well, absolutely. I mean, part of what I worry about every night, actually, is just, you know, making sure that kids are safe and that we've done what we can to keep kids safe. Certainly, we ask a ton of our workers. We ask a ton of our supervisors. We've been reviewing cases and situations. So we try to have multiple people kind of involved in checking up on situations to make sure kids are safe. But it's certainly something that we worry about.
You certainly have ways, I'm sure, in your department, your agency, to sort of prioritize these cases and which ones deserve the more immediate attention.
Absolutely. So one of the things we did when I got here was really look at our Kansas Protection Report Center, which is where the calls come in.
Right.
And we have really streamlined from the moment we get the phone call to the point at which we send that out to the field to be investigated and the turnaround time to reviewing those situations. Again, to make sure that we're getting folks out there as quick as possible. We're also having somebody double check that the cases that we screen out that we don't investigate, that's a right decision. So we have two and three eyes looking at those that we screen out, because as you'll recall, when I first got here, we had a couple of cases where the situation had been screened out and then something awful happened. And so we've changed our criteria, and we have two and three people looking at those that we screen out. But we're also streamlining the process with which we get those referrals out to the field, again, so that we can hopefully get someone out there quicker looking at the situation.
Are you getting more calls today than you've ever had before? Is there an increase? Is it flat? What are you seeing?
Certainly, the calls have increased over time. I haven't looked at the number most recently to see if that trend has continued, but certainly when I got here, that number was higher than it's ever been. And I think people's education on the issue, and certainly we've been in the news and not been shy about the need to keep kids safe and the need for everybody to call. So I don't think the number is decreasing in any way.
You were talking just a minute or so ago about the people who take the initial calls, who come in over the hotline, I guess you call it, when a neighbor might see something across the street and want to get attention focused on it. There was a little concern in the media not long ago about a lack of training for these initial call takers. What about that?
We absolutely have been working again to do, we've revamped our entire training for not only our investigative staff, but also our Kansas Protection Report Center. As you'll recall, we had the Annie E. Casey family come in and look at the front end of our system, and they made, I think that's where the initial report came out about
right.
the caseloads and how high they were.
They did a big review of your whole system.
Yeah, and yeah. That was at our prompting and our asking them to do that, because, of course, they're a nationally known organization, and it kind of came out of the task force, the discussion about that. So we certainly embraced that, and they brought to light several things we could do policy-wise to streamline the process, training-wise to strengthen our approach, and we've implemented many, many of those.
You've said you weren't surprised by what that report showed you.
No, I wasn't. Again, 25 years in the system and working in and around the system, I feel when I came, I knew what we were facing. I think the big piece was, when you have it in numbers and you kind of look at what the national trends are and you put it in numbers, it really brings to light some of the issues.
I'm just wondering, again, our listeners might be curious about this. What does it take when your agency, DCF, receives a phone call and something appears to be wrong with the way a child is being treated? What does it take for your agency to go in and actually remove the child from a family?
Well, certainly, I appreciate that question, because I think a lot of people think that the agency just does the investigation and then we make a decision, and that's simply not the case. If we decide that a child is at risk, we present that to the county attorney or the district attorney, and then the county or district attorney decides if they're going to file a case. And then, of course, the court ultimately has to agree that, yes, that child needs to be removed. So there's at least a three-part process to us removing a child. Now, law enforcement...
How long does that take, typically?
Well, obviously, if we're asking for a child to be removed, it's because they're in danger. So, it happens quick. I mean,
yeah.
it's a quick process. Show up, present it to the DA, go to the judge. I mean...
A day or two?
Sometimes same day, sometimes
really?
An hour.
Yeah.
It just depends on how the county or the court process works.
Yeah. So this notion that there might be kids in homes who are in danger, the hope here, the objective is to get them out as quickly as you possibly can.
Certainly. I mean, yeah, again, if they're in danger, working with law enforcement. I mean, that's the other alternative is we can go to law enforcement and ask them to do a removal immediately. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so if there's something where it's taking longer to get the court process filed or whatever, we can go to the law enforcement and ask them to take immediate action as well.
I'm wondering about the turnover in your department. If you're able to pay your people what you think they need and deserve to do the important work that they do.
I think, you know, again, I don't think there's ever going to be enough money necessarily to pay them what they're deserving of in terms of the public service they're doing for our state. I think our salaries are pretty average when we look at what other, you know, other folks doing this work across the country are getting paid. So I think we're getting, you know, we're paying decent. I don't think it's what we would want it to be. It's certainly part of what we'll be talking about with the legislature when they come back in the next session.
You know, DCF, again, the Department of Children and Families, has been in the news so often for so many reasons the last few years. I'm wondering, at the end of the day, to what extent are the issues that you face caused by a lack of money? You don't have the money at your disposal to present and staff a department that you know you've got to staff.
Well, I appreciate that question, too, because I do think, again, I feel like when I came, I knew that we had issues. I don't know that I understood how maybe deprived financially the agency in child welfare in particular. I feel that we were. We had high caseloads. We had vacancies that weren't filled. We had overwhelmed staff. We didn't have prevention funding. We didn't have placements. I mean, so all of that takes financial resources. All of that takes human resources. And really attending to each one of those things very meticulously, which is what we've done. But the agency hadn't requested additional resources for years. Hmm. So, of course, I think it was the second day I came in, we asked for additional resources, and we got them during the last legislative session, and we'll ask for more during this legislative session.
I was going to say, Gina, how much more do you need to do the job you want to do? I mean, you're looking at 10%, you're looking at 40%. What's your need?
Well, it's huge because there's several things. I mean, there's the human aspect of the case managers and paying them, again, a decent wage. Then we have infrastructure issues like computer issues computer issues that haven't been dealt with for years, and nobody likes to fund it, but it does lead ultimately to child safety. So that's a huge ask, of course. And then, of course, we want to do more prevention work, and we want to fund our child welfare contracts. So all of those pieces add up, and that's not to mention even a lot of the recommendations that are going to come out of the task force. So, I mean, ultimately we're talking millions and millions of dollars that need to be invested in the system.
There's a task force now studying the department to see what other needs might be. Can you give us a guess? Again, is it 10% or is it 40%?
I know that we have a very big ask in our current budget, but I hesitate to say that without the new leadership and the new governor coming in. So certainly whatever budget's presented will be the new governor's budget. So I can tell you it's a big budget ask.
Again, the Democratic candidate for governor, Laura Kelly, is saying you're vastly underfunded. I mean, that message has come from her pretty clearly.
Yes. Senator Kelly's been on the task force, of course, studying the issue. And so she knows all of the challenges the agency has faced.
You know, you get the sense, again, I'm visiting this morning with Secretary Gina Meyer Hummel, who oversees the Kansas Department of Children and Families. You get a sense, again, from reading the news reports, from hearing you talk today, that the challenges that you face are just ultimately overwhelming. How do you deal with that?
Well, we can't get overwhelmed because there's a lot to attend to. And really, I brought a great team around me, and they're hardworking public servants, and we have great teams out in the field doing the work, caring for families every day in Kansas. And so I feel very privileged about having those folks at the table with us. We have great partners around the state who also come to the aid of helping Kansas families. And we really have just kind of laid out the groundwork of all that needed to be done and really meticulously worked through every aspect of what we know needs to be improved. We're certainly not done yet. We have a lot of places we can go and a lot of areas we want to go, but we've really laid really decent groundwork for the future.
No question, this is hard work.
No, it's hard work. We're very blessed to be able to do it.
You know, I want to go back to some of the other findings of the report that you referred to this morning that looked at the front end of your system. One finding, children had 8.9 homes for every 1,000 days they were in foster care. So they're moving from home to home to home pretty quickly. That's more than double the national or the standard out there of four transitions for every 1,000 days. You're more than double of that. That's a hard number to hear.
It's horrible. I mean, that's a horrible number. That means children are experiencing trauma in our system. And so we have absolutely got to do better than that. We have
trauma because they're changing homes so often. There's trauma associated with that.
Absolutely.
You're
saying. Yeah. Trauma associated with that. I mean, you know, if you're unsure about where you're sleeping, if you're unsure about where you're going to go to school, if you're concerned about having to move the next day, I mean, all of those things create uncertainty and then ultimately lead to, you know, mental health issues and perhaps bad outcomes for kids. So we certainly have to do better than that. We have the new child welfare grants coming out. They'll be out. We'll announce those very quickly, but they will hopefully solve that issue moving forward. We've instituted a placement matching system that is meant to match children's needs with the best placement in their home community or their surrounding community so that we can keep children placed locally and keep them near their families. So ultimately, again, the goal is to get them home, or if we can't get them home to permanency, then get them to adoption quickly. So the placement matching system will help to solve that issue.
How big of a need is the number of foster parents willing to take on that role?
It's a huge need. We always need foster families because, you know, every child that we have has unique challenges, unique differences, and we need families, you know, of all types coming to the aid of those kids.
Another finding from the report, the agency assessed family strengths and needs within 30 days, just 66% of the time. Standards call for timely assessments 95% of the time.
Right. So again, it kind of begs the question of the need to have more workforce in order to be out there quicker, in order to be more thorough in your assessments.
You know, one of the recommendations of this task force you've alluded to, Gina, that's wrapping up its work was to expand access to TANF, that's cash assistance to those on welfare, and to SNAP, those are food stamps. But I'm told that you oppose that move, even though a recent KU study suggested a link between the soaring number of foster care kids in the state and access to welfare assistance. What about that?
So we've looked at the study that was done, and we're actually having another study done to look at that very issue as well, and we expect that to come out soon. But the numbers and the data that we've looked at, and we've looked at, you know, as folks have kind of come off the TANF roles and the foster care roles, and we've studied that who's coming into care, and we don't see any correlation in those two numbers.
But it sort of makes common sense to me that if a family has better financial resources, that the problems wouldn't be as great.
Well, again, we're looking into making sure that there's no correlation, and we're studying the issues. We also have instituted, which I think is really important, we've instituted risk removal staffing. So what we were finding, and what I think the report indicates, that 50% of the children in Kansas were coming into care for neglect, not mm-hmm. for abuse, not for what we think of traditionally sexual abuse, horrible physical abuse. They were coming in for neglect. So we are really looking at those families who come to our attention because of neglect. Is it poverty related? Is it that they don't have a job? Is it that they have a substance abuse issue? And we're really trying to figure out. So we're having a multi-agency staffing of those particular families who are at risk, and really looking at can TANF or EES, is that an option for this family? Would that help them? So we're trying to not only look at the policies and make sure we've lined them up right, but then also look individually at each particular family situation.
But people might look to you, the head of the Department of Children and Families, to be an advocate for more financial assistance for those on welfare. I mean, to get welfare assistance in Kansas, Gina, I'm not telling you anything, you got to be way below the federal poverty level. We are a really cheap state when it comes to helping folks who are poor. Why not lead the charge on that? It just seems that would be a better thing for kids and for families if they had a little bit more money.
Well, certainly we have been focused, as we looked at TANF reform and welfare reform, we've really been focused on helping people get out of poverty and helping them get into gainful employment and gainful jobs. And we've been very successful at that. If you look at the unemployment rate in Kansas, it's one of the lowest it's ever been in the history of the state. And so, again, we're certainly looking at the policies, but we're also really looking individually at each individual situation and looking at you know, our TANF programs and are there folks that we're missing? Can we do outreach in some way? Are there folks who could benefit from our program who currently aren't benefiting? So we are looking across the board at making sure that we're right where we need to be.
But again, if you aren't an advocate for this, then who's going to be? I mean, you deal with this every day. You see poverty more closely than almost anybody else in Kansas. And if Gina Meyer Hummel isn't advocating for more cash assistance, who's going to lead that charge?
Well, I certainly think, I mean, you've certainly heard from the advocates. There are a lot of people who have this as their issue. Like I said, we'll continue to look at the policy and make sure that we're where we need to be. But we're really focused on the individual family and how can we help the individual family. And again, studying the policy to see if it's where it needs to be.
Again, Gina Meyer Hummel is my guest. She heads the Kansas Department of Children and Families. Haven't asked you a couple basic questions yet. There's been news stories about foster kids being forced to sleep in state offices because you couldn't find family placements for them. Is that still happening?
It's not.
Not at all?
Not at all.
That's news. Is this a new development?
We haven't had a child sleep in an office since September 21st.
Okay, so that's completely. How have you been able to move forward on that?
Well, it was one of the things we talked about eliminating when I first got here. I mean, I feel good that we've eliminated that as a practice. We have worked with our contractors to add additional residential beds to the continuum of care. We've certainly continued to recruit foster families. We've taken initiative to find permanency more quickly for families and kids in the system. We're looking at relative placements and stepping up our relative placements. We're adding crisis beds to the continuum of care. So we're finalizing a number of adoptions before the end of the year. So we're, again, you know, the more kids in care, the more stress on the system. They take resources. So if you can reduce the number of children safely in out-of-home care, get them with family, get them with an adoptive resource, keep them at home to begin with,
right,
you lessen the stress on the system. At the same time, you add additional resources to the system.
There's also been a lot of concern expressed for children in foster care who go unaccounted for. The number in the 70s, maybe the 80s a few months ago. Where does that number stand today? Children in the system that you don't know where they are?
Well, hopefully you've seen the report where we had a drastic decrease from last August to this August.
Yes.
Of the number of missing youth, although it's still too high for my own comforts. We have 75 youth today who are missing or who have left their placement. Again, most of them are youth who are in care, who have left their placement voluntarily. So we are working. I mean, I feel good because we've found hundreds of kids through this process. And again, that you pick them up and then they choose to leave again. And so we're talking with our court partners about what do we need to have in place to better serve them so we don't find them and then they don't turn around and leave. We're looking at staffing those individual situations to see, you know, if they're going back and they're being, you know, hidden by family members or friends. Is that an option for them to just stay there? Can we make that a safe place for them? So each individual of those that we found, and we also are adding a youth advocate. So for every one of those children that we find, we're putting in place a youth advocate. And really, that's someone who will be there individually for them so that if they're concerned, if we find them, get them in a safe place, then they will have somebody if they feel like they need to run or they don't feel like they have somebody to talk to. So each one of those kids we're putting an advocate in place for.
You know as well as I that politicians often say the number should be zero. The system, every child should be accounted for. You just said you have 75 today. Is there always going to be some number out there because kids do run away? Kids do, lots of things happen involving kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's very scary, of course. We don't want kids to leave their placement. We don't want them to be in questionable situations. I do believe it will always exist. Certainly, what we know is that we're one of the only child welfare systems in the country actively looking for this youth, which is really scary. In fact, we haven't found another state that institutes and has an investigative team actively searching
to
for
go
those
out and
folks.
Look for kids.
Yeah.
One final point. I haven't asked you yet about the story last month involved a 13-year-old in the state's custody who reportedly was raped inside a child welfare office in Olathe. The young man arrested in connection with the assault also was in Kansas's care at an office in Olathe. Both were waiting to be placed in an available foster home or facility. Where do we stand with that?
Well, certainly, again, we haven't had any youth who stay the overnight in the offices, and so we're glad about that. We certainly
do. The case is being adjudicated somehow?
Yeah. I mean, I think the court's taking care of the legal issues with the alleged perpetrator, and then of course we got immediate services in place for the victim, and it's a horrible tragedy. I mean, it should never happen, and we should never have kids in offices. So
that's Gina Meyer-Hummel. She's secretary of the Kansas Department for Children and Families. I really appreciate you coming in and answering questions, Gina. I know this is tough stuff, but I think it's great that you're talking to us about what's going on out there.
I appreciate your interest.
Thanks very much. Coming up, when we come back, we'll visit with Stan Kessler, one of the mainstays of the Kansas City jazz scene. He's been playing his horn for 40 years in this town. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Yesterday in the show, we found out that national polls in the 2016 election were actually pretty accurate, but state polls, maybe not so much. Can we trust political polling this midterm election? You can find out at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Kansas State Senator and gubernatorial candidate Laura Kelly will join us. We'll get her thoughts on gun control, education funding, and her plans for Kansas if she becomes governor. Well, if you've ever spent much time listening to Kansas City jazz, chances are pretty good you've heard Stan Kessler, the outspoken trumpeter, aren't all trumpeters outspoken, has been a mainstay in the Kansas City jazz scene here for decades, and music reviewer Bill Brownlee, writing for KCUR, says he's never been better. Stan has done it not just on talent alone. He's figured out a way to make a living making the music he loves, and that's a trick for any jazz musician. Before you meet Stan, who's a former Plastic Sax Person of the Year, here's what he sounds like. This is Dave's Place from his 2017 release, Skywatcher. Stan Kessler joins me now. Nice to have you here. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You bet. I can't believe you haven't been on before. I'm thinking, what's been wrong with me?
Nothing's wrong with you.
Well, something's wrong if I haven't had you on before. That song, Dave's Place, sounds pretty darn good. Did you write that?
I did.
And what's Dave's Place refer to?
Well, it's about David Overmeyer, who's a jazz aficionado and just a great guy, a drummer, lives west of Topeka on a farm, and he's the guy who hosts the post-concert buffets and get-togethers for the Topeka Jazz Workshop.
Oh, no kidding.
I've known him for years and years, and I was staying at his house just for an overnight chill-out thing, you know. And he left to go to a gig, and I was sitting at his piano, and this just kind of rolled out of me.
No kidding.
Yeah.
As it does sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes it does.
And other times.
Other times not.
Forget it, eh?
Yeah.
You know, there's this notion that you've carved out a living playing jazz in this town. How much of a feat is that in and of itself?
It is a feat, quite a feat, I think. You know, you have to be persistent and have faith that things are going to continue to go. And you just keep plugging along and, you know, doing hopefully all the right things. you know, and so it keeps going.
And you do it how? How many nights a week are you performing right now? Because if I look at your calendar, you're a busy guy.
I am busy, and it varies. It's, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 nights a week. Just depends. It kind of comes, and it's not steady. It's here and there. But I also teach, and most of us do. So mm-hmm. and most of us, one of the things about making a living in this business is that your income is diverse.
Mm-hmm.
You play, you teach, you have recording sessions, you play. A lot of guys have church gigs, you know, a little bit of sales from CDs, stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me that you play in as many as 10 groups at a time. I mean, different styles of music. Right. I mean, and that's probably part of your genius here, in a sense. You've been able to survive because you've got something to offer to everybody here.
There's some elements there. One is, I love all kinds of music, so that helps.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized early on that the more things that you can do, the more money you're going to make, right?
Mm-hmm.
And being a trumpet player, I also realized early on that I was going to have to be more motivated to go out and generate income, because trumpet players are not the first guy that's called. It's usually piano, bass, drums, guitar, you know, mm-hmm. rhythm section people that stay busy and don't have to try as hard. And so you have to be really self-motivated and get out and beat the bushes.
You got to call people.
You do, and you got to hang out and meet people,
mm-hmm.
and you got to be good with people. I mean, I like people, and mm-hmm. that helps. You know, you have to enjoy being out there with other people and meeting folks and.
Tell us about some of these different groups that you're in right now, because it's a pretty lengthy list.
Well, some of the groups are dormant temporarily because they're – well, just because the venues we used to play at are no longer open. But I do have the Sons of Brazil, which is my flagship group.
It's well
been
known.
Together for 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
That's amazing.
It is, actually.
Yeah.
I have various trios, quartets, quintets playing – music around town.
Do one-on-one with singers in town?
Yeah.
Kathleen Holman?
Yeah, Kathleen and Justin Binnick and Charles Williams and various people, Danny Embry, doing smaller groups but playing American jazz standards. I have a band called Horoscope, which has been dormant, but we're going
to
play...
A tribute to Horace Silver, the great pianist from back in the day.
Correct. Yeah. And we're playing again in November after a layoff of a couple of years. And then I have... Parallax, which is a quintet with two drummers,
yeah,
and Passport, which is a duo with Bo Bledsoe,
which is wonderful stuff, by the way.
Thanks,
just wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it's a departure. It's not really. It's sort of jazz meets world music.
Yeah, which is what Bo does.
Yeah,
I mean, what determines when one group is active and a group goes dormant? What is it? Just gigs, and what you can get, and
I mean, like I said, some of the places that we were playing, like Take Five Coffee Bar and the Art Factory, those two, both in Johnson County, no longer open, and they were helping me as far as being able to play whatever.
Right.
You know, I could take whatever band in there and fill the room up with people. So that's basically it. It's just the right venue with the right space and the right amount of money.
You know, the scene is constantly shifting, constantly changing. Is that tough to navigate? What's open,
well,
what's not?
Where I kind of got used to that. I mean, it has changed. Change is the one constant.
Yeah.
It's always changing. Venues come and go. People come and go. Again, it's like you have to be okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be okay with the instability of the business. And if you're not, you know, it can be demoralizing. But I'm still okay with it.
You know, you got the Green Lady Lounge, the Black Dolphin, which strike me, you know, as maybe one of the focal points now of the scene. And it seems like Tom has sort of figured out how to make this thing work.
Yes.
It's amazing to me. John Scott.
Yeah, John has.
It's, you know, it's a 7-day a week thing.
Yeah, he definitely has a formula that's working. In fact, that's where Horoscope is playing, at the Green Lady.
Huh.
And he does have the Black Dolphin is, well, both places have, you know, quintets,
mm-hmm.
quartets, whatever. bands that play original music. He really likes original music, which is great. The Black Dolphin, is especially, I'm fond of that place because it's actually set up more like a music room.
Yes.
With the bar in the back, it's a wonderful stage, and it sounds really good. And, you know, they have sound men that come in and dial you in and on the PA. It's great. So,
I mean, why is his thing working and so many other venues have struggled and collapsed and gone away?
That's a good question. I think one of the things that John does is that he wants music that he emphasizes music that relates to the common man or the common woman, you know, the people who aren't necessarily jazz fans. He's targeting the general public. And that, I think that helps.
Yeah.
The because, average. You know, yeah, just having the people who, the jazz blue bloods, isn't enough. You need to expand your audience and appeal to a broader range, a broader demographic.
You know, Stan Kessler is my guest. Let's play another track from Stan Kessler. This is Remnant, again from his latest album, Skywatcher. Stan Kessler is my guest. That's from his latest track, Skywatcher, the track Remnant. I'm wondering, Stan, how do you balance, I mean, what you need to do to connect with audiences with your own artistic sensibilities, you know, and playing what you really like to play, which may not always satisfy some audiences? That's got to be a hard rope to walk.
That is a great question. Yeah. And that's one of the keys to my success, or anybody's really, I think, is that you figure out where your artistic needs overlap with what appeals to other people. If you want to keep working, if you don't want to keep working and you don't care, then you can play whatever you want. And some places you can do that. But I really want to play for people. I want people to enjoy what I'm doing, but I also want to enjoy it as well. So there is an overlap there.
A lot of jazz guys, as you know, they're out there pretty far, and the audience is sort of left way, way behind. And you sort of scratch your head sometimes.
Yeah, that's okay, as long as you don't care about whether or not people... If you want to... I mean, everybody wants people to like their music. They really do. But you got to know what you're dealing with. And if you're okay with that, that's fine.
Yeah.
I've done that, too. You know, sometimes there's a time and place for that. And that, you know... Just like, well, here it is, and I don't care if you like it or not. That can be fun, too. but it doesn't pay the bills.
You have to be in a nasty mood when you do that?
No.
What does it take when you get to that point?
Yeah, really some sort of shame spiral or desperation. You know?
Yeah.
No, not really. It's just every once in a while you want to play stuff that is just what comes out of your soul and without any regard for any acceptance. You know, I think everybody wants to do that in whatever line of work that they're in at some point or another.
So just bottom line, how healthy is the scene right now? Again, it's ebbed and flowed in Kansas City. What are you seeing out there?
Oh, it's just great. I mean, it's really grown.
It's going the right way as far as you're
concerned.
Well,
it is. There's more venues. There's also more musicians. You know, there's musicians moving here because they hear that there's work. So right now there's a pretty good balance between work and players, you know, supply and demand, if you will.
Right.
I mean, I'm a businessman, so there is that component, you know, supply and demand, and, you know, having a balance where there's enough work for everybody is great. That will change one way, or it might get better. It might get worse. You just never know. So things tend to go in cycles.
Hey, how often do you have trouble getting paid? You always hear jazz guys have gotten stiffed. Is that, you know?
You know
what?
I haven't been stiffed in years.
Is that right?
I have not. That used to happen. Used to happen more. I don't have that problem anymore.
Thank goodness.
And I don't really know anybody who does. I think that's sort of gone away, which mm-hmm. is great.
How often do you say no to a gig because it just doesn't pay what you think it deserves?
Oh, often.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you just say, hey, thanks, but no thanks? It's...
Yeah, I mean, it's not like every week or anything, but I mean, maybe once a month that happens, which is often.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wish that would go away. I wish, you know, that's one of the things I really am a big proponent of, getting the pay up.
Mm-hmm.
And some people can afford to pay more than they are. Some of it is they're not, they just don't want to. Some of it is the musicians don't ask for it.
Hmm.
It was a bit of an issue. You know,
a sense like, they're just happy to play anywhere for anything?
Yeah, sometimes. And it depends on the venue. You know, if it's someplace where they're making money off of you, then you should get paid appropriately.
I mean, do you get mad at folks who will just take a gig at any rate because it drives down the price for the rest of you? Does that happen?
I don't care for that.
Yeah.
It happens. But again, it depends on the situation. If it's in a place like, let's say, Westport Coffee House, their Black Box Theater,
right?
You're playing for the door. You're not taking away work from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going into...
You get every ticket that gets bought and people come in.
Yeah, or you don't make any money and you know you're not going to make any money. You just want to play your art,
mm-hmm.
you know? And that's what happens down there in that room, and it's great. But if you go into some place and that's a restaurant or a bar and you lowball other people, it's just like any other business. You know, that's not cool.
Do you play better for bigger crowds?
I try not to, but sometimes that happens.
You
can't
help it, right?
Yeah, you can't, but you're human. I try to play every note like it's my last note, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
There could be nobody in the audience, and I'm human. I do like a room full of people.
You know, Louis Armstrong, you know, always had all this stuff to take care of his lips. You know, the salve and all these secret ingredients, and I don't know what was in that stuff. Is that an ongoing concern for you when the weather gets colder? Or yeah, are you care of the lips and all that?
A little bit, you know, if your lips get chapped and they start peeling, that's an issue.
Because
then it's hard for your lips to vibrate. But I don't like putting anything on my lips right before I play. I might do like some vitamin E or something at night when I'm sleeping just to keep things, you know, happening.
But, yeah. You know, you've played with so many of the great Kansas City players over the years. Who stands out as you look back over your time here, people you were thrilled to have had a chance to play with?
I'm still playing with them.
Yeah.
Danny Embry, Doug Allwater, you know, Roger Wilder, Bobby Watson.
Yeah.
Well, you know, some of them are gone now, but a lot of the cats are still around. I know I could be naming off names for
ever.
An hour, but I'm just.
But you're known for raving about the young guys on the scene too.
Oh my goodness.
The young lions that you're.
Oh, they're terrific.
They're coming out of UMKC in a lot of cases.
A lot of them are.
They're pretty darn good.
Yes, they're frighteningly good.
Frighteningly good. Really? Is that right?
Yeah.
Can some of them top you sometimes, you think? I mean,
it this way. I have students out there like Herman Mahari.
Yes.
And Nate Nall, who are kicking you know what and taking names. I mean, they are amazing.
I hear nothing but good things about Nate Nall. It's a new name to me, but I've been hearing it lately. Yeah.
And, you know, Clint Ashlock was a student of mine for a minute. And there's others, Nick Howell. And so, I mean, there's quite a few guys out there that I love hearing them play.
Hmm.
It's actually keeps me going in a sense that, man, I have to keep up with them.
Yeah.
You know, and the great thing about Kansas City is that it's not really competitive. It's not like some other cities. Everybody's really supportive of each other.
Oh, that's cool.
And I hear that remark when people move here. I get, wow, everybody's so friendly and supportive here. And I think, well, isn't that the way it's supposed to be? you know.
That's but nice to hear,
it's not
actually.
Like that. It is. Yeah. It's not like that everywhere.
Stan Kessler is my guest. Why the trumpet?
I don't know. It was either going to be trumpet or violin.
Really?
There's a big disparity there, I know.
Yeah.
And then, funny thing is, I heard this corny song on the radio. It was a big pop hit by Al Hurt called Sugar Lips.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, and it was like an AM instrumental hit, and that was the thing that pushed me over to the trumpet, you know? Isn't that funny?
Well, I played trumpet as a little boy.
I didn't know that. Junior,
and my thing was Herb Albert. I used to listen to Whipped Cream and Other Delights and just think, the album cover being alluring, there was the
have
sound.
Have you seen my parody on that album cover?
I have not.
I'll send it to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
The first band I was in, half of our repertoire was Tijuana Brass.
I mean, it was such great music when you were in seventh grade.
Well, back then it was happening. It was the deal. Yeah.
But you stayed with Trump. Did it come to you pretty easily, or how did it roll for you?
It kind of did at first. I mean, it's not an easy instrument. Brass is not easy because the thing that, you know, all sound starts with vibration. And with the brass family, the thing that's vibrating is your face. Mm-hmm. So it's hard.
Yeah,
you have to maintain it. You have to keep playing and practicing and doing the right things so that you can go perform. You can't just lay the horn down for a week, you know.
Well, let's go out with a little more Stan Kessler. This is Jim's Delight. And Stan, what a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it and love seeing you out and hope to see you soon.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
That's Stan Kessler. We all know the Civil War saved the Union, but what about the desperate battle that saved Lincoln and doomed slavery? Tomorrow, historian and writer Justin Martin shares the details of Antietam. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.